The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you very much for that gracious and wonderful introduction, Helen Miller. And it's wonderful to be here in Philadelphia, my first time at the Philadelphia Free Library. I've heard about this event for a long time and always wanted to stand on this stage. So it's a pleasure. My friend Jacob, an ardent intellectual and a distinguished journalist with a PhD in political science, has a quick mind and a subtle wit. Born in Hoboken, New Jersey, the only son of Jewish immigrant parents, he is a man of expansive warmth, whose greatest pleasures are relational and social, and whose currency of discourse has always been language, a rapid-fire delivery blending a New York Bronx dialect with a sprinkling of Yiddish for emotional effect. Now 62, he tells me of the first experience he's had attending a seven-day silent retreat where, after much resistance, fear, and panic, then resolve and determination, he began to let down his barriers and inhibitions and learn to live in the stillness. This still raw understanding and practice of meditation has opened a whole new discipline and perspective that seemed to, as he puts it, challenge old inhibitions and raise questions about who he is becoming and about his capacity to be alone with himself. He says dramatically, "Meditation is the most counterintuitive thing I could have possibly tried to learn to do." And there is Robert, the 72-year-old retired mechanical engineer who I meet at an ice cream joint on the side of the road in rural New Hampshire. He and his wife of 50 years are out on their ritual Sunday drive, and they are looking to pick up an interesting conversation with a stranger. They sit down next to me at the picnic table and begin in a place where we all meet, with family stories. I listen to their proud tales about their grandchildren scattered all over the country and admire the photographs of their smiling faces. But soon, with a bit of gentle prodding from his wife, Abby, the conversation turns to Robert's new passion, and he goes to the car to fetch his drawings, postcard-sized pen and ink sketches of birds. He has always loved birds, listening to their songs in the morning light, watching them visit the bird feeders outside his kitchen window, observing the social interactions among them. And he has always said, "I wish I had an artistic bone in my body so I could draw the beauty I see in them." A week after his retirement party, as he faced the surprising emptiness in front of him, he took the leap of faith and signed up for 3 drawing courses, what he called a total immersion, at the Adult Education Center. "This has become my life," he says, in confessional tones, as I remark on the steady improvement I see in his portfolio of work, and as he talks about the exhilaration and vulnerability of learning something new. It was because of scores of ordinary, everyday encounters like these with people who were risking the unknown, embarking on new learning, and re-envisioning their lives, with people whose voices held a mixture of passion, anxiety, and secrecy, that I followed my curiosity and embarked on a 3-year research project of inquiry, witness, and storytelling, interviewing and observing 40 women and men across the country, a journey that culminated in my new book, the 3rd chapter, Passion, Risk, and Adventure in the 25 Years After 50. My book focuses on the creative and purposeful learning that goes on between 50 and 75, the chapter that follows young adulthood and middle age. It asks, what are our sources of inspiration? What are our greatest fears and inhibitions? What are our major barriers to learning? And what allows us to pursue new adventures? How are the processes of learning, adaptation, experimentation, and mastery different during this period of life? Do maturity and life experiences support a greater sense of liberation and collaboration, a new level of patience, perspective, and confidence, and a sturdy sense of self that permits risk-taking? How do we hang on to our dignity, sense of authority, and self-respect when the awkwardness and imbalance of new learning make us often feel infantilized? How do we balance and negotiate the tensions between the losses and gains of new commitment? What are some of the things that we in our third chapters discover that we cannot learn? And finally, what are the connections that can be drawn between individual learning, cultural creativity, and community building? What institutional innovations, shifts in cultural priorities, and educational reforms might support the translations from individual gain to public good? As Helen Mello said, a look at the recent census figures begins to tell the story of the emerging voices, visibility, and vitality of the promise and prominence of those of us in our third chapters. 10,000 baby boomers turn 60 every day, and we are healthier, better educated, and yearning for a productive and enjoyable alternative to retirement. The arc of life and learning is continually being expanded and redefined. Not only are people living longer, but demographers tell us that the third chapter represents a new and definitive developmental period in our culture, one that comes on along, it turns out, only once a century. Last century, for example, we discovered and labeled adolescence as a distinct developmental period between childhood and adulthood. We began to see it as a time of enormous change, drama, and fluctuation, as an explanation of new alignments in the strained relationships between parents and their teenagers, as the initial treacherous steps towards individuation and self-definition. Adolescence then became a cultural construct that was stamped into our psyches and written into the social scripts of our families, our schools, and our communities. So this century is ours, and I'm speaking from the middle of the third chapter. We are forging a new and distinctive chapter in life. Those of us between 50 and 75, those of us who are neither young nor old, are beginning to redefine our views about the casualties and opportunities of aging. We are challenging cultural definitions of strength, maturity, power, and sexiness. This is a chapter in life when the traditional norms, rules, and rituals of our careers seem less encompassing and restrictive, when we are embracing new challenges and searching for greater meaning in life. The boomer generation, once defined by our youthful boldness, bravado, achievements, and opportunism, bring to this third chapter our wealth and our resources, fewer resources, less wealth these days, our social capital and sense of authority, our appetite for new learning and lives of service, our yearning for inspiration and adventure. It turns out that reinvention in the third chapter is filled with poignant paradoxes. We experience the twin sensations of loss and liberation, constancy and change, urgency and patience, hard work and exuberant play. The process of learning something new feels both familiar and strange, exciting and terrifying, mature and childlike, both in character and out of body, like returning home and setting out on an adventure to an unknown destination. This is true whether we are talking about learning a new skill, craft, or art form, like learning to speak a foreign language, play the jazz piano, or become a playwright, or whether we're learning to feel or express a broader and deeper emotional repertoire, freeing us from the bondage of the rigid requirements of decorum forged in our childhood, or whether we are learning to grieve after the death of a loved one, learning to make ourselves vulnerable and not retreat from intimacy, or whether we are talking about shifting the focus of our energies and priorities from solitary, individualistic, and competitive to community-based and collaborative, from making it up the ladder of success to making an imprint on the lives of others. One of the central paradoxes that I explore in my new book, the one that I think resonates most deeply with this moment in our country's history and with our individual and collective quests, I call looking back and giving forward. Giving forward, making a difference, leaving a legacy, holding each of us accountable to something larger than ourselves. These impulses in us echo the clarion call of our fearless leader, President Barack Obama, and they are particularly poignant and powerful for those of us in our third chapters. It turns out that we in our third chapters are able to tolerate the imbalance, risk-taking, and vulnerabilities of leaving the old and entering the new when we can begin to picture and then compose and narrate our new life. Ironically, the pictures that we construct are often shaped and shaded by our returns to our childhoods, to the values and rituals into which we were socialized in our families of origin, to the historical and cultural moments in which we were embedded. We look to our origins, to the lessons we learned at home about service, charity, justice, about collective responsibility and citizenship, and often feel for the first time compelled to find a way to enact those values and principles. By this stage, we are likely to have accumulated a rich array of experiences, resources, and skills that we are yearning to use wisely and well. Over the years, we have honed our expertise, identified our gifts, and learned how we learn. What seems to surge us up in us like a compelling imperative is the wish to give forward, to be useful, to make an imprint. In the third chapter, we want to turn the tables, rewrite our priorities, reinvest in our relationships, recalibrate the meaning of success, and even re-envision the concept of work. I use the term giving forward rather than the more typical notion of giving back, as a way of reflecting how we in our third chapters must develop ways of engagement and service that point toward the future and not get stuck in the anachronisms and nostalgia of the past. In order to be useful, we must respond to the contemporary context and envision a future into which our altruism might contribute. We need to listen to the voices and views of our children and our children's children, an intergenerational discourse that offers clues about how we might serve and be useful. Looking back honors the wisdom and weight of our ancestry. Giving forward is futuristic and transformational, enriching and enlarging those who give and those who receive. Philosopher Frederick Buchner captures the mutual gain and the real meaning of the word charity, a benevolence and generosity that gives forward and circles back. He puts it this way: your vocation is that place where your deep gladness meets the world's hunger. End quote. So here are two stories, both local and modest, and beautiful and earth-shaking, both about the taking of small, courageous steps deeper and deeper into the world. The first about planting gardens, and the second about teaching astronomy. Both narratives resonate with the powerful dialectic of looking backwards into the future. And after I tell you these stories about these two people, I will close, because I'm always a teacher at heart, with four powerful meta lessons. Okay, a story about planting gardens. The last artifact Charles Watson carefully packed as he left the corporate law practice that had consumed the last 40 years of his life was an old photograph of his mother and himself at 8, standing in the garden behind their house in North Carolina with shovels in their hands, smiling into the camera, faces happily smudged with dirt. Looking at the photo always reminded Charles of his greatest childhood pleasure, planting the gardens, flowers in the front, vegetables in the back, with his mother. When he was a very small child, his mom would let him sit on the edge and dig in the dirt or run up and down the rows of corn and cucumbers. When he got to be school age, he would run home from the school bus stop, quickly change his clothes, grab a snack, and join his mother in the garden. By the time he was a teenager in high school and an athletic and academic star, he had no time to work in the garden or hang out much with his mother, for that matter, both of which he secretly missed. As Charles packed up his law office and carefully wrapped the photo, he knew where he was headed. He was getting ready for a costume change. No more shiny corporate suits. Now it would be worn jeans, a dirty sweatshirt, and his big heavy boots, which he called shit kickers. Charles began very modestly fixing up a tiny plot in front of his brownstone, designing an elegant Japanese-inspired garden with beautiful smooth stones and rare miniature trees. But within months, he had offered his services to the neighborhood association, clearing and planting the narrow park in the middle of his block, painting the big planters and filling them with unusual combinations of bright flowers. Then he was on to volunteer at a newly renovated children's art center, where he started from scratch, digging a new foundation for brick patios, wooden benches, handsome shrubs, and flowering magnolia trees. Each evening, Charles would return from work, his gait weary, but his face beaming like he must have looked in the childhood photo with his mother in the garden in North Carolina. In the last year, he has found, as he put it, a regular gig, close to Chinatown, working in a large city garden where folks, all Chinese, grow their crops. One day, Charles, who had passed by this garden for years and looked longingly at the people bent over in their labor, decided to walk over there and see what they were planting. He loves flowers, but he had missed planting vegetables, missed the exquisite pleasure of tasting the luscious tomatoes in his salad taken fresh from the garden. The folks, mostly grandparents themselves, some with their young grandkids twirling, as he had once done up and down the aisles of vegetables, at first looked a little skeptically at Charles, wondering what this tall white man, who looked for all the world like a corporate lawyer dressed in overalls, wanted from them. They didn't talk very much. There was a language barrier, but soon one of the men beckoned for him to come over and see his row of bok choy, and Charles gladly sauntered over to admire the healthy crop. The next day he came back first to watch, then several days later to work. Now almost any day you can drive by the garden and see one tall man in a Red Sox baseball cap in the midst of a bunch of short Chinese elders in their broad, flat straw hats, bent over tilling the soil, working away silently in the hot sun. Even though Charles approached his work with his mother's garden tips clear in his mind and heart, he quickly discovered that he had a lot to learn. This time round, he learned to learn by carefully watching and witnessing, not talking and explaining. He learned how to plant economically and strategically on narrow strips of land, and he learned some new tricks for irrigating the city's soil. He learned the Chinese names for produce he had never tasted before. He learned to love the slow pace, the sun on his face, even the physical weariness after a day of digging. Charles suspects that in the next several months, he may begin to feel the urge to expand his horizons a bit, maybe even find a way to use some of his legal expertise. He might, for example, volunteer his services doing pro bono legal work for one of his favorite community service organizations, or he might explore the possibility of taking on a part-time management role at a small organic farm just outside the city that has asked for his help. But in the meantime, laboring in the Chinese gardens is Charles's chosen vocation, and it echoes with the deepest pleasures from his childhood. Each day it feels like looking back and giving forward. Now a story about teaching astronomy. Roma Wolf, a 57-year-old physicist who has spent all of her professional career in the laboratory, enjoying the quiet and order of the space, the exacting familiar rituals of the scientific process, and the pursuit of the objective quantitative evidence, recently began to feel, after 30 years, the limits and constraints of her existence. The solitude and discipline of her work that used to feel safe and generative started to feel claustrophobic. The rituals began to seem routine. The questions that used to inspire curiosity began to strike her as dull and formulaic. But mostly she sensed the need to, as she put it, make a difference on our planet in a more direct and immediate way. She yearned to teach, to serve, to give forward. Cutting back on her hours in the lab, Roma signed up for a mentoring program where she teaches middle school black, brown, and poor students in an after-school program, the subject which always fascinated her the most when she was a young adolescent, astronomy. In her first year of teaching, Roma admits that this is the hardest, most challenging work that she has ever done, learning the science now long forgotten and finding a palatable and relevant way to present it, learning to relate to and discipline the children and capture their imaginations, learning to recover from the awkwardness and public failures that come with being a total novice. "I'm so completely uncool," she says with a smile. But harder still is what she calls venturing forth into places formerly forbidden, places she used to consider ominous and dangerous. Even though she has lived in Chicago for the past 30 years, first as a graduate student, then as a research professor, Roma had never traveled far from the shadows of the university. She had never even dared to drive through the mean streets of the West Side, even with her car doors locked. Never ever had a real conversation with an adolescent. She is single and without children of her own. Never experienced being the token white person in a crowd of black folks. Never felt so far outside her element. These were all new experiences that felt both exhilarating and terrifying to her. The most difficult part of venturing forth, she claims, was losing her fear, being willing to face the unknown, and ridding herself of the deeply ingrained prejudices which had contained her life and restricted her movements. Now, after almost a year of working with the kids, after months of awkwardness and many missteps, she has begun to feel a little bit more comfortable, a little less foreign, and a lot less afraid. Now when Roma teaches them astronomy, the subject that she loved the most when she was their age, she looks into their faces and occasionally recognizes herself. She can begin to see in them the curiosity and eagerness that she once felt. "The kid in me has been sparked," she exclaims, looking amazed at the familiar sight she sees in this still strange place that has begun to feel like home. These two stories of Charles and Roma begin to weave the tapestry of collective wisdom that I gathered from the 40 women and men whose new learning and giving forward I was privileged to witness. This evening, I want to conclude my talk with, as I promised, four large meta-lessons, and I call them large meta-lessons because I have stuck a whole lot of other little lessons in there so that there will only be four, so you can keep your attention here. And these lessons are on education, on intergenerational relationships, on crossing boundaries, and on imagery and innovation. Let me hydrate myself first. So the first, on schooling and learning. New learning and giving forward in the third chapter will require us to rethink the purposes, structures, and boundaries of schooling in our society. As I listen to the narratives of my interviewees, I was struck by the contrasts and contradictions that they drew between their formal education from elementary school through college and graduate training and the motivations and challenges of their learning and service as older adults. The very attitudes and aptitudes that had made them stand out and excel in school, competition, speed, caution, singular ambition, seemed to be barriers to the risk-taking, collaboration, patience, and adventurousness that allowed them to embark on new learning 30 or 40 years later. They had to, as one person said, unlearn old school habits. Others talked about having to shed the negative and pejorative labels bestowed upon them, wittingly or unwittingly, by teachers who saw them as lazy or stupid or unmotivated, labels and prophecies which had left deep scars. New learning in their third chapters required that they confront the ancient wounds, recover their dignity, and rise to the challenge of rediscovering their gifts. As an educator who has spent the last 30 years of my life studying the culture and character of schools and the trajectories of human development and learning, I am dismayed by the myopia and short-sightedness of educational policies and practices that do not anticipate the long trajectory of learning across the life cycle. I believe that the designers of childhood education need to consider the developmental tasks of adulthood and old age, as well as those of childhood, when they construct curricula and develop effective pedagogies. Using an architectural metaphor, sociologist and lifespan theorist Orville Brim warns, and I quote, "To study childhood without its lifelong aftermath is to pour a foundation and neglect the edifice." End quote. My second lesson on intergenerational relationships. Not only do we need to redesign our schools to honor the central dynamic of continuity and change across the life cycle, we also need to reduce the generational segregation and the perception of generational competition and territoriality between the young and the old that permeates our society. The movement across school community boundaries needs to flow in two directions. Children preparing to live as citizens in an increasingly complex, diverse global reality need to be offered opportunities for apprenticeship and service in the real world. And people in their third chapters need to be seen as valued mentors who bring with them not only the accumulated knowledge of our work and careers, but also our wisdom, experience, and sense of perspective. The crossing of boundaries for both generations needs to express a respectful reciprocity, a dynamic pedagogy in which young and old are both teachers and learners. In order for a culture to flourish, younger people need the stories of older adults living among them. Likewise, the composing of our third chapter narratives helps each of us identify and express our own creativity, generosity, and service. This was certainly the case as I listened to third chapter learners who discovered, while they told me their stories, new insights into their own motivations and capacities, and a new sense of control and agency over their actions. Their stories became their anchor. Their stories became their compass. And the third lesson is about crossing boundaries. Those people who are courageous and generous enough to risk crossing boundaries into the unknown in their efforts to learn something new and give forward, whether they are navigating the borders of race, class, gender, generation, or geography, seem to follow similar steps on their journeys. The first step is curiosity. Women and men who navigate the boundaries of learning begin always with a deep curiosity. They are interested in knowing something new, understanding the way something works, asking the probing and impertinent questions, and seeking a new way of being in the world. The second step requires that they let go of the fear of the unknown and the fear of failure. Conquering the fear is not done by some rational listing of the pros and cons, or by some calculation of the benefits and the liabilities, but by deciding ultimately to take the audacious leap of faith. Once we take the leap of faith, we face the possibility of failure and the probability, at least in the short run, of making fools of ourselves. Humor saves us. Losing the fear opens the way for step three of the border crosser's new learning, the willingness to be vulnerable, open and exposed, to fail publicly, to experiment without embarrassment and humiliation. In fact, failure becomes one of our most important diagnostic tools for learning, and it is the best way to learn how we learn. Developing empathy is the fourth step that boundary crossers must master in learning something new and giving forward. We must be able to put ourselves in the place of those who are our teachers, those we are seeking to understand, who have a different perspective or a strange way of doing things. The final step, one that we can see most clearly, I believe, in our rear view mirror, is the recognition that new learning does not mean losing touch with the life on the other side of the border. As a matter of fact, the work of the third chapter is integrative. We find ways of constructing something out of the disparate elements of our long lives, expanding our repertoires, and merging the old and the new into something whole, layered, and deep. Says novelist Toni Morrison, who speaks from the outer edge of her third chapter. She puts it this way: the borders are our natural sites of creation, the places where we invent, transgress, and create. End quote. And the fourth and final lesson, have you noticed that I've put lots of lessons in each one? Just packed it in. The fourth lesson is on imagery and innovation. Giving forward should not only be seen as an individual pursuit, a solitary gesture of goodwill, an act of heroism by one brave soul. Fundamental social change will require collective action, including challenging the negative and infantilizing cultural imagery that distorts the lives and identities of older adults. It will require changes in the public discourse and policies that offer us greater visibility and voice, and it will require major institutional innovations that allow for more access and opportunity. Currently, we are missing the necessary infrastructures that might effectively harness the action and energy of those of us in our third chapters. Organizational redesign of other arenas of learning will have to allow for shifts in our routines and rhythms across our lifetimes, offering us multiple opportunities to recalibrate the balance between work and love, between work, family, and community, between work and play, all of which may help us revise and expand our definitions of a meaningful and purposeful life. Citing a confluence of changes in life expectancy, in developmental patterns, and in societal expectations, cultural historians Moody and Cole call the third chapter a season in search of a purpose. A season in search of a purpose. What a perfect sentiment for this moment in history and this season of our lives. We in our third chapters can become pioneers of purpose, helping to lead the way in a new and compelling vision of later life, a vision that inspires and provokes all of us to find large and small ways, dramatic and subtle ways, extraordinary and ordinary ways, to learn something new, to innovate, to reinvent ourselves to give forward. So inspired by the luminous narratives of our pioneers of purpose in my book, in our neighborhoods, across the world, let us go forth and plant our gardens. Let us go forth and with deep gladness meet the world's great hunger. Thank you very much. Oh, I'm looking out and seeing friends. This is so nice. Feels like home. I'm open for comments, questions, just no second lecture. Yes, sir. I'm sorry, there's a mic that
will come on. Yes. On your fourth point on imagery and innovation, you mentioned the idea of needing different types of organizations that are related more to collective action. And I wondered if you could give some examples of that.
Well, we already see some of this happening. I think one of the older organizations that allows older adults, people in their third chapters, to reinvent themselves, to learn something new, to be engaged in intergenerational learning, are community colleges, frankly. I think they are one of the great institutions across our country. Unfortunately, many of them are suffering from financial problems now. But where, for a long time, first of all, first generation college goers can go, but also older people go back to school, even if they've gone to school and finished college in another domain, in another discipline, and take on this new learning in the midst of other people of all ages, but particularly young people who they can have sort of cross-generational discourses with. Also, all over the place now, we are finding universities that are even building structures close by for older Americans so that they can become re-engaged in university life. The University of Michigan is an example of that. So that the notion of sort of fluidity in and out of learning institutions is very much there. But I also think that institutions, organizations, corporate organizations, hospitals, other places that hire people need to find a way to let people go and have people return. I mean, one of the big privileges, frankly, of being a university professor is sabbatical, right? It's one of my favorite things. But it is the opportunity to go away, to regenerate yourself, to retool, and to come back with new ideas and new perspectives and a new humility about what you don't know. There's always this opportunity. And so the notion of figuring out a way to make the walls of institutions less insular, less hard, more porous, more fluid, so that we can move in and out of them across a lifetime. And as I said, recalibrate the ways in which we balance work and play, the ways in which we balance love and work and family and work and community. I think we need to rethink some of those things in a very creative vision and not get stuck so much in this lockstep sort of hierarchical vision of learning that ends, you know, in our normal construct, in the old traditional way, much too soon. Yes, sir.
Professor, I compliment you on the beautiful way that you use words and so precisely.
Thank you.
My question is, how do you distinguish between risk and adventure? Can you have risk without adventure in your mind and adventure without risk?
Wow. I think that you probably could have adventures without risk and risk without adventure, but I think taken together, they're really potent and powerful. I think there's some way in which being slightly on the edge, slightly anxious, just a little bit worried, somewhat exposed and vulnerable, is really where we are when we are on the edge of learning. And unless we are willing to take the risk, unless we're willing to make ourselves vulnerable, unless we're willing to make fools of ourselves, unless we're willing to let people laugh at us, which is for some of us a great risk, then we don't experience the adventures ahead. One of the things that I feel, I was talking today to actually my media escort about the anxiety I always feel before I give a speech. I've given thousands of speeches. I do it all the time. I travel across the country. I teach hundreds of students. But there's always this knot in my belly. It always feels risky. It always feels as if I'm vulnerable up here and exposed. And I remember saying this to my father when I was a young professor. He was a great professor of sociology. And he said, when you stop feeling anxious, stop teaching. Right? Because that means, what this is saying is, I want to do a good job up there. I want to take the risk of really communicating to you all what I think I know. And it is something that's very important to me. I've been working on this a long time. How can I do it? And that's why I love that you said, my words are right. Because I worked on my words, right? But I do think that a real adventure typically has some moment of great risk. And that risk feels adventurous. And so that taken together, I think it's the real deal.
Could you comment on what the third chapter would look like for people who've had a career in the helping professions? Because you talk about corporate types who then go and help, but what if you've been giving, giving, giving? What does the third chapter look like?
Well, you know, the book has a lot of narrative about people who have really been giving, giving, giving. You know, who have been of service to other people in nurturing, nourishing roles. And many of those people turn towards, frankly, art, artistic endeavors. You know, they are the people who begin to study jazz piano. They are the people who begin to paint. Things that sort of in some ways are quieter, are less public, require less relational encounters, and allow them to be still and with themselves, feeding themselves in a way. So I think it's a very good question, because I think that often what we're looking for is sort of to extend the repertoire of ways we are in the world and to make the shift from something that has grown old, not because it's bad or uninteresting, but because we've done it so long. And we know it so well, and it's become routine, and the rituals are kind of imprinted on us in a way that begins to feel claustrophobic and routine. And so we go to something new where we don't know the boundaries as well, we haven't learned the rituals, we have to figure out the norms, all of that. And so I think it's a wonderful question. You go to where you haven't been. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for your presentation, Doctor. I'd be interested to know what you discovered about people learning more about their health as undertaking certain risks and seeing that they do have some consequences sometimes.
That's a very interesting question. First of all, I think that there's a way in which we have to reframe getting slower, right? Because we get slower, and we recognize, we begin to talk about patience as a wonderful thing. And it's true that somehow the sort of meditative, patient, deliberative place that we get to, not because necessarily we want to, but because our bodies and minds are telling us that this is what's important, that this is the only thing we can do, becomes a new way of knowing the world, a new way of learning. And it's very interesting to see people in their third chapter go and tutor kids, kindergarten kids, for example, or third grade kids, and to recognize how lovely it is to have this kind of grandparent rhythm going, you know, that isn't as feisty, as aggressive, as impatient, as urgent as maybe the parent rhythm is. So I think there's a way in which things like patience, my favorite, learning restraint, when not to do something, when to pull back, when to let the silence just sit around us, when to wait, knowing that waiting is good. Those kind of things, I think, come with getting older, and if we reframe them, can really be assets in new learning and giving forward. I also think that the people I talk to became much more unwilling to be preoccupied with their health problems. That is, they stopped conversations that began to get boring, after all, with these organ recitals, you know? And they also, by contrast, took more control of their own health, took more control of their lives. My mother, who's 94 and fabulous, and wonderful, one of the things that I heard her doctor just a couple of years ago say to her, and she herself is a physician, is the reason that you've lived so long is that you've been in charge of your health. And he wasn't meaning because she's a physician. He was meaning because she's taken charge. She's taken charge for what it is that's right for her. She's taken charge for asking the penetrating questions. She's taken charge, and now with the web, doing the research. So it's both this business of deciding that that this will not become a total preoccupation, but also deciding that there's some way in which you're going to take charge of it. Yes.
Hello, you were fabulous, thank you. You just mentioned about grandparenting third graders, and you talked about silence, which I have come to greatly, greatly need and appreciate in my third chapter here. However, sometimes I think there are some of us who are thrown in limbo because we're forced to have to become a parent all over again to our grandchildren. And at times, it's so wearing and tearing. It's very precious. And there isn't a whole lot out there that is really that supportive to grandparents. Have you done a lot of studying on that? Because there's more and more of that in this culture and society today.
I haven't done purposeful studying on that. There were a few people who were my interviewees who, in fact, were both of them grandmothers who were acting like mothers. In other words, where they were primarily raising their children. And part of what they were struggling with is exactly what you're talking about, which is that they really felt as if they had earned this place of rest, recuperation, regeneration, self-love. And then here comes another generation of children to raise, and that all other stuff felt crowded out. And I think that what they were trying to do, first of all, is to begin to not feel ripped off by it, begin to form a community of other women, in this case, who were in the same place and with whom they could share stories, and begin to find a way, even though it felt impossible, to find a space each day that they would just call their own. I mean, now, I haven't had this experience, although I am a brand new grandmother. I haven't had this experience, but I remember as a mother sitting in a coffee shop for 15 minutes and pretending I was in Puerto Rico. You know, the sun was coming in the window, and the vitamin D was hitting me, and I was just feeling, for that moment, the serenity of being present in the universe. And I think that there is something almost, those sort of existential moments is what we are trying to grab when our lives are so unbelievably crowded out by having to give to others, particularly the second, or even for some, the third time around. So, I mean, that's not terribly helpful, but I do think that there are more spaces than we sometimes recognize. And the other thing that both of these women said is they were not grandmothering these children the way they mothered their own. In other words, they didn't have the kind of democratic, progressive, you know, let it all hang out ways, because they didn't have the energy for that, and they just didn't have the time for that now. So these children were being raised differently than their children were being raised. They raised their own children. Is there way back there?
Can I just first of all thank you for a wonderful, wonderful presentation?
Thank you.
From my point of view, as I approach retirement, I'm thinking of words like risk. I'm thinking of words like vulnerability, opportunity. My concern is the risk of not moving on, the risk of continuing with habits I've established over 30 to 40 to 50 years. I've always felt before you can move on, you have to unlearn an old habit. And I find it that the challenge very often is getting away from your behavior that you've lived with for so many years and having the guts to go on. Yep. And rediscover yourself.
That's very, very well put. One of the great developmental psychologists who wrote about this first and probably better than anyone else was a man named Erik Erikson. And he wrote a book, probably many of you know his work, called Childhood and Society, in which he lays out 8 stages of life. And the third chapter that we're in is the penultimate stage. And he labels it generativity versus stagnation. And at each one of these stages across life, he says, we experience a crisis of moving forward or being held back. It's a very, very tough tension. And we work with it and we struggle with it, and we don't beat it all of a sudden. You know, it just doesn't happen that we're victorious over stagnation all of a sudden. It's a really hard, hard struggle. And there's always this possibility of being pulled back to the routine, pulled back to the stasis, pulled back to the boredom, which is stagnation. When people say, I'm burnt out, it's not because they've worked too hard. It's because they're bored stiff. That's what it is. And so the alternative to this generativity is, as you put it, sir, is exactly stagnation. And I think that we fear that just as much, as you said, as we might fear the risk and the vulnerability of moving forward. And Erik Erikson talked about this in the early 1950s. Yes.
Can you speak to the issues that whenever...
This is our penultimate question, I've just been told.
Okay. Can you speak to the issues that when you're married and you're approaching this time when you really want to, like, jump out and do something different, but you've got a husband who's going on a different track. I think keep thinking, you know, we should each find our passion and our love to do something else, but it does certainly create, I think, tension between two people.
It's a lot of the folks I talked to spoke about this. And one man I spoke to put it this way, and this is not atypical in terms of the pattern of men and women at this age although it doesn't completely characterize it. So this man said to me, I'm in my rowboat, and I'm rowing towards shore. I'm anxious to get home. I'm coming on in. And I look over there, and she, meaning his wife, is in another canoe, and she's paddling out to sea. Right? So the kind of complexity of all of this, to put it, you know, sort of mildly and neutrally, the complexity of all this is to often have to risk, or it feels like a risk to the relationship as it has grown used to itself, the relationship. And the ways in which you have patterns, and the ways in which you have rituals, and the ways you are with one another, and even the power relationships between you, that's worked for a while. And that's all threatened if someone says, I mean, really, I've got to go and work in Zimbabwe. Yeah, this is the only place where I can plant my garden. And as a matter of fact, I've got to do this solo, right? I've got to find my wings and fly. And the other person inevitably feels left, I mean, you know, abandoned. As a matter of fact, one of the women I talked to says that her husband used the word sabotage. He's trying to sabotage my efforts at adventure and new learning, subtly and explicitly. So what I really discovered in this was that there is a little bit, at least the way people talked about it to me, a little bit of feeling of risk and worry and concern as you try to make the next step. And what people said is that they felt as if they had to be much more articulate in naming what it is they were feeling, in naming where they thought they might be going because they weren't sure, and in naming the fact that they wanted to hang in this relationship, but that it would need to find a way of adapting to the new scenario. In other words, a lot more talk, a lot more empathy for what the other person might be feeling and worrying about as they watch you walk away, watch your back. I think that, so I, a lot of people talked about it. And as a matter of fact, one of the reasons that I promised people in this book anonymity was that a lot of them wanted to talk about the impact of these experiences on their love relationships and how really hard that sometimes is to figure out a way to be together and change. Thank you. That's it.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.